you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up later this hour, fascinating study recently published in the journal Nature. We'll talk about experimentation, which allowed a mouse embryo to be grown in an artificial womb for several days. The potential, of course, after many more years of research, could be quite remarkable for human fertility. That's coming up later this hour, but we turn our attention right now to COVID-19 and the very latest news with UCLA School of Public Health epidemiologist and professor of medicine, Dr. Timothy Brewer. Dr. Brewer, very good morning to you.
Good morning, Larry.
Let's talk first about what we just heard on the NPR Hourly News, and that is the CDC reporting that this variant out of the UK is now the most common of the variants here in the United States. When it was first identified, we heard of its greater contagiousness and its greater ability to lead to more serious symptoms. Your thoughts about this now being the dominant variant here?
So, Larry, this wasn't surprising because the early data coming out of the UK when this virus was first described, variant was first described last summer, showed that it's about 50% more transmissible. So I think it was only a matter of time. But what people have to remember is the original Wuhan virus was actually very rapidly replaced by a variant first in Europe and then the United States last spring. So what most of us think as COVID-19 virus is actually not the original virus that was described in China. It was a variant.
Let's talk about some of the different variants, because you mentioned we have the original strain that came to our attention out of Wuhan. We then have the variant from the UK, and this is the first concern we have over an even more serious variant, South African variant, Brazilian one, and we hear about one here in California that is our own homegrown variant. So, you know, looking at all of these, you know, comparing them, which is the one we need to be most concerned with?
Well, they all actually have a lot of overlap. So right now, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is tracking five variants that they call variants of concern. So that's sort of the mid-level where they either show increased transmissibility or increased seriousness of disease, but they have not yet been demonstrated to totally get around our vaccines, for example. And in that, we have the UK one, the South Africa, Brazil, and the two Californias, as you mentioned. But the UK, South Africa, and Brazil actually share a number of common changes among them. So there isn't so much difference among those as people might think.
We hear, you know, a lot of the public is concerned about the variants. One of the reasons that, you know, they'll give for still being very cautious even after being fully vaccinated is the variants. But how might that reveal itself that the vaccine isn't protecting against a particular variant? Would we start seeing more than likely just a few cases at a time, sort of giving warning to people that it's not effective against a newer variant? Or could we see a flood of cases from a particular variant happen very fast?
So we certainly could see an outbreak, and I think that's the big concern that everybody's worried about. We have two kinds of data. So we have data from actual trials. So remember, for example, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, two trial sites. One was Brazil, one was South Africa, in addition to the United States. And both of those trials were done when those variants were spreading. So we have actual data on how well Johnson & Johnson works. The second is we actually check it in the lab. So both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines have been checked against the variants in the laboratory to see how well do the neutralizing antibodies still work.
So it sounds like it would need to be a new variant that would be the cause of concern getting around the vaccines that we have now?
So the good news right now is while all three of those vaccines that are currently available in the United States are less effective against the South Africa and Brazil variants, they still offer enough protection to prevent serious disease, hospitalization, and death. And importantly, the vaccine seemed to work very well against the UK B.1.1.7 variant. So that particular variant, both the Pfizer, Moderna, and the Johnson & Johnson vaccines are still offering excellent protection.
We're talking with UCLA School of Public Health Professor Dr. Timothy Brewer, epidemiologist and professor of medicine. If you have questions for him about COVID-19 and about vaccinations, please ask them now at 866-893-KPCC. You can tweet at AirTalk, post on the AirTalk Facebook page, or post on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. The Los Angeles Times reporting that scientists at Stanford University have identified here in California a variant of the coronavirus that was first identified in India. It doesn't yet have an official name, but the BBC nicknamed it the double mutant variety. It contains two mutations in its genetic composition, identified among other variants of concern the CDC is tracking. Dr. Benjamin Pinsky at the Clinical Virology Lab at Stanford says we don't know how the two mutations behave when they're paired together. Your thoughts on what the discovery of this double mutant coronavirus here in California means?
It doesn't really mean anything, Larry, because all variants have multiple mutations in them. So to say it's a double mutation makes no sense at all. So, for example, the B.1.1.7 variant is defined by 23 different mutations, seven of which occur in the spike protein of that particular variant. So all of these variants have multiple mutations, and the question is, are those mutations important or not? Fortunately, most of the mutations are not. Some are. For example, in the UK, South Africa, and Brazil variants, there's a mutation called N501Y in the receptor binding part of the spike protein that probably is what makes it more transmissible. So it's not the number of mutations, it's really, does the mutation cause a particular change in the virus that we need to be concerned about?
All right, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. AstraZeneca's vaccine is being paused for use with adolescents in the European Union, that because of concerns about blood clots. I thought those concerns had largely been put to bed, Dr. Brewer, but we now have the EU saying that for those under 18, they're going to look at an alternative vaccine. What are they seeing?
So we don't know yet, and actually, they haven't released their data from their original study. So we had that report from a week or two ago that said no clear association between the AstraZeneca vaccine and an increased risk of blood clots, particularly a particular kind of blood clot inside the brain. But we haven't actually seen the data from those reports to know why they came to that conclusion. And I think it would be very helpful to get those results out.
What alternatives have been approved in the EU? We've heard so much about the Oxford developed AstraZeneca vaccine there. I don't even know what else they have in the EU.
So I don't know for sure. I know that in the United Kingdom, they've been using the Pfizer vaccine in addition to the AstraZeneca vaccine. But across the different parts of the EU, I don't know quite which vaccines have been approved or not.
All right. Again, I welcome your calls for UCLA School of Public Health Professor Dr. Timothy Brewer. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. I was seeing a story in the Los Angeles Times and just hearing anecdotally of how far some younger Californians are driving to get vaccines when they come available. Bakersfield is a place that has had doses there for people who've driven north out of the Los Angeles basin to go up to the Central Valley to get vaccinated in Baker. Hear about another young adult who went out to Victorville to get vaccinated. My son was looking at driving to Lancaster before he was able to get a vaccine closer in Glendale. But people are driving quite far afield to get vaccines. And it just, you know, reminds us, Dr. Brewer, how some people are so motivated to get vaccinated, and for others, it's just a no-go. They're just sitting it out. And do you think for many of those people that they are going to, the resistance is going to break down and they're eventually going to get vaccinated?
Well, we certainly hope so, because that's one of the keys that ties into the issue we were talking about earlier about variants. Variants can only occur if the virus is replicating and transmitting. And so if we can shut down transmission and replication, we don't have to worry about variants. And hopefully what will happen is more people will recognize that these vaccines are very safe and they are very effective, and we can overcome that hesitancy to try and get them vaccinated.
Do we know anything from previous vaccination efforts where there's been reluctance for people? I mean, even going back as far as the polio vaccine, do we know what the degree of public acceptance of that was? Now, there's a big difference in that. It took many years to be developed.
So we are amassing more data, but it's still an area where we could do better than what we're doing. So we know that among certain Hispanic and African-American Black communities, there has been hesitancy around using the vaccine. We also know that among low-income areas, has not been as much vaccine as there could be. So, for example, Kern County is one of the counties with the most widespread COVID right now, and it has one of the lowest vaccination rates. And so we clearly have to work on getting the messaging out in an appropriate manner that people can understand and answering their concerns so that they will feel comfortable being vaccinated.
And I guess that's why Bakersfield has enough extra vaccine that they're vaccinating people from Los Angeles County, is because the adoption rate of vaccination has been comparatively low in Bakersfield itself. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. This is your opportunity to ask questions about COVID-19 and about vaccination. Jody in Pacific Palisades says, why did it take 100 years for there to be a global pandemic? And citing the Spanish flu, of course, is the last one.
So actually, Jody, we've had a number of pandemics since 1918. So there was an influenza pandemic in 1957. There was a second one in 1968. And the most recent one was the H1N1 pandemic in 2009, 2010. The reason why you don't remember that pandemic was the associated mortality rate of that particular virus was about 0.02% in the United States, but about 61 million people were infected with that virus over 1 year. So we were lucky. It was a very transmissible virus, but it was not a particularly deadly virus.
And as you list off those years, it would appear there's no particular rhythm, kind of like earthquakes. There's no rhythm to when we get a pandemic. It's not cyclical or predictable.
That's exactly right. And there's a lot of effort that goes into doing surveillance for looking for new pandemic viruses. And that's exactly what happened in 2009. So there was a clinic in Southern California that identified an untypable influenza A virus in April of 2009 that immediately sets off all kinds of alarm bells and turned out to be the pandemic virus that we now know as 2009-2010 influenza.
Bob in Downey says, I had a bad reaction to the first Moderna vaccine on Monday. I had chills, fever, headache, but it seems to have eased after a day. I had COVID in January. I'm wondering if I need to get the second dose of Moderna or not. Is it important just to get to show that I have it on my vaccine card, or is it something that would really benefit me?
So Bob, there are data to show that people who've had documented COVID-19 do get a tremendous boost from vaccination, even just with one dose. But we still recommend that you go ahead and get the second dose. So we do know that people who've had COVID respond well to the vaccine and get a higher level of protection by being vaccinated, even if they've had disease. So do go ahead and get that second dose, please.
Should you be prepared to be getting quite a wallop after that second dose?
So the second dose does seem to be a little more problematic than the first, but as Bob and I and many others who have been vaccinated experienced, these are transient symptoms. They usually tend to go away within 24 to 48 hours, and they often respond to Tylenol, Advil, and similar kinds of fever and pain medicines.
All right. So that's even for people who've recently had COVID-19 itself. They don't have necessarily a rougher go after the second vaccine?
Not necessarily that we know of. What we do know is that they do seem to get a better immune response from the vaccination. So that's actually good.
As though they're primed. Dr. Timothy Brewer, epidemiologist and professor of medicine, UCLA School of Public Health. We're at 866-893-KPCC. We'll be back in 1 minute. It's Air Talk on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. It's our daily update on COVID-19 with Dr. Timothy Brewer, UCLA School of Public Health, professor of medicine, epidemiologist, and served on the advisory boards of the World Health Organization, National Institutes of Health, and the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention. We're at 866-893-KPECC. Amanda in Pasadena asks what is fundamentally, I think, an unanswerable question, but a good one for us to discuss nonetheless. The CDC recommends against non-essential travel. What is essential travel? And certainly, Dr. Brewer, much of that is going to be in the eye of the beholder. Does visiting a family member you haven't seen in over a year, is that in some cases essential, other cases not? How do you determine that?
So a terrific question, but one thing to remember is the CDC has also changed the guidelines for travel within the United States for people who are fully vaccinated. And by fully vaccinated, that's defined as 2 weeks after your second dose of Pfizer or Moderna, or 2 weeks after the single dose of Johnson & Johnson. And so it is and getting easier to travel around. In terms of what is essential, you're right. I think that's an individual judgment call. If I had an elderly relative who I knew was sick or dying, I might consider that essential, particularly now that I've been vaccinated.
All right. 866-893-KPECC. JP writes on the page, I had what was called Hong Kong flu back in the early 70s. Gosh, JP, I'd forgotten all about that. About half my Pepperdine College dorm was really sick. I've never felt sicker since. Was that a pandemic?
So that was an influenza outbreak. So we used to name influenza viruses by the locations where they started from, except for the Spanish flu of 1918 actually began in the Midwest United States. I'm not quite sure how they managed to get it named the Spanish
flu. It's probably
flu.
A PR move, I'm guessing.
Probably a PR move. But so Hong Kong flu was a typical influenza virus, and that probably was a particularly bad year. But the last influenza virus before 2009-2010 that actually met the definition of pandemic was 1968.
I do remember, though, that early 70s outbreak that JP posts about. There was a tremendous amount of news coverage of that at the time. JSK asks, if we get to pretty good vaccine herd immunity in the country, while most of the world is far away from that, does that suggest international travel restrictions would be in order?
So we already have international travel restrictions in place, and I think that's part of why the Biden administration is talking about trying to get vaccines out to other countries as well. Because remember, as long as that virus is replicating and transmitting anywhere in the world, it can lead to new variants that could escape the vaccines that we currently have. So it's not only important to contain the virus within the United States, but we really need to contain it globally.
Laura in Santa Monica, responding to our previous caller who'd had COVID in January, then was recently injected with Moderna and had a strong reaction to that first dose. Laura said, I was in the same position. I had COVID, then took the first vaccine and had similar side effects to the caller. But after I got the second one, I had very minor symptoms. So, Laura, thanks very much. We'll hope that our listener who was concerned about what effects there might be after his second shot, good to hear that for you, the second was less of a reaction than the first. Alexandra in Westwood says, I've had both doses of the vaccine, zero side effects other than a sore arm. Do you have to have side effects in order for there to have been an immune response?
No, Alexandra, you don't. So the side effects do not have any role in telling us what kind of immune response you've had to the vaccine. We do not routinely test people to see if they've generated an immune response after being vaccinated, but that would be the only way to know for sure.
All right. 866-893-KPECC. John asks along this same line, if bad reactions to the second dose are because our immune system recognizes the spike protein and revs up immune response causing side effects, then why is it people who contract COVID after full vaccination end up with mild symptoms, if any? Wouldn't it also rev up the response and give those bad symptoms as well?
So that's part of why you can't use symptoms to predict how well the immune response is working. The reason why you tend not to have a bad reaction to the virus if you've been vaccinated is that your immune system is primed to recognize that virus and shut down replication very quickly before it can cause those worse symptoms.
866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Leora in Westlake says, my mother and I have both been vaccinated a number of times in our lives. For some reason, the vaccines have not persisted as long as they do in other people. Something happens with our immune system. I know we're resistant to MMR vaccine. Is likely we'd be resistant to COVID-19 as well. Leora, I'm wondering how that was measured, how you would know about that. Can you explain this, Dr. Brewer?
Well, depending on what kind of work Lenore and her mother do, somebody might have measured her antibody levels to MMR. So, for example, as a healthcare provider, if I go work in a new hospital system, one of the things I'll do is check my MMR immune levels. That having been said, Lenore, you might talk to your primary care doctor about being evaluated by an allergist immunologist if you think there really is some concern that you're not responding to vaccines. So we do have ways of measuring the immune system and understanding if there are problems and offering some potential treatments.
All right, 866 893 KPECC, Carmelita and Boyle Heights, wondering, are there any individuals for whom the vaccine is not recommended? Is there any category of people? She mentions compromised immune systems, and we know it's, you know, particularly important for people that are vulnerable like that to get vaccinated. But are there any people for whom they should think twice about getting it?
So, yes, if you have an allergic reaction, especially a severe allergic reaction to any of the components of the vaccine, then you should definitely talk with your healthcare provider before being vaccinated. But that's really the only major area right now. These are non-replicating vaccines. That means they cannot cause disease, and so they're safe to use in people who are otherwise immunocompromised, unlike our live viral vaccines like MMR. So these are vaccines we can use in people who have organ transplants or have HIV or other immune compromising conditions.
I was trying to get my hands on it. I thought I had the article in front of me, but I think I saw that nationally there have only been 66 cases of anaphylactic response to people being vaccinated, and no hospitalizations required, no fatalities. Which that seemed quite low to me. I don't know if you have better numbers or maybe happen to see that that finding.
So the CDC has looked at this through the vaccine adverse reporting system that we have in the United States. For the Pfizer vaccine, it occurs in the order of about 5 cases per million doses. For the Moderna vaccine, it's around the range of 2.5 to 5 cases per million doses. So you're right, Larry, it is very, very low right now. But if you have any concerns that you might be allergic to a component of the vaccines, then just talk with your healthcare provider and they'll be able to help you work through that and determine which vaccine may be the most appropriate for you.
Alex in Burbank says if you're fully vaccinated and you're in that small percentage of people who then get COVID-19, how should you deal with that? Should you quarantine for 14 days, for example?
So we're now suggesting that you isolate for 10 days. So isolation is what you do if you have the disease. Quarantine is what you do if you're exposed to the disease. So if you do get sick with COVID-19, even if you've been fully vaccinated, you do still need to isolate for a minimum of 10 days and until your symptoms are better and you've been without fever for at least 24 hours, having not taken any antipyretic medicines like acetaminophen.
All right. Speaking of lasting concerns, 1 in 3 COVID-19 patients are diagnosed with a neuropsychiatric condition over the course of the next 6 months. This, according to a large study that was published in the Lancet Psychiatry Journal, looking at the incidence of 13 brain disorders, anxiety, mood, substance use disorders, most common. But researchers also found worrying but lower rates of serious neurological complications, especially in patients who had been severely ill with COVID-19. In all COVID-19 patients, just about half of 1% developed a brain hemorrhage, 2% an ischemic stroke, and 0.7% dementia. Now, this is obviously going to be an older population, right, Dr. Brewer, just because of those who've gotten sicker with COVID-19.
That's correct. And if you read the actual journal article, which I have, one of the things you'll find out is a number of those chronic conditions, such as dementia, were present in patients beforehand. So they do break it out by both people who've had the problem before and people who've never been diagnosed with the problem before. The majority of the problems were anxiety disorders. So over half of that, roughly 33%, about 17% were anxiety disorders. And we know that this is a a very difficult time for a lot of people. So I'm not surprised that anxiety is being diagnosed more commonly in these individuals.
Let's talk with Michelle in the Carthay Circle neighborhood of Los Angeles. You're on Air Talk.
Hi, good afternoon. Nope, it's still morning. Sorry.
Yeah, we'll be there soon, though, 20 minutes.
I received my first Moderna vaccine 3 weeks ago, and 6 days afterwards, I felt a little twinge in my arm, which then turned into a giant rash and allergic reaction, hot and itchy and painful, which lasted 4 or 5 days. And I Googled it, and apparently it's called Moderna arm, a rare reaction, but other people have obviously had the same reaction. And I get my next vaccine next week, my follow-up. I'm wondering if it's something I should anticipate happening again, or if it's just kind of an aberration, and it's just very bizarre.
Yeah, sounds like it, Michelle. Dr. Brewer?
So, Michelle, these have actually been described with both of the mRNA vaccines, the Moderna and the Pfizer. And I've taken care of a number of patients with this kind of reaction. We don't know quite exactly what's going on, but we think it's some type of delayed type hypersensitivity reaction. But as you said, it does eventually go away and does not seem to cause any sequela. But if you have any concerns before your next dose, you should just sit down and talk with your healthcare provider. But in general, we have not seen serious problems with people who've had this reaction, even when they get their second dose.
All right, Michelle, thank you so much for your call. We're looking right now at California having a particularly low case rate of COVID-19 compared to other states. But it's fascinating that just five states account for 43% of the entire country's COVID-19 cases over the past week: New York, Michigan, Florida, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. Why do you think those five states are seeing this surge?
So part of it goes back to what we talked about earlier, Larry, with the B.1.1.7 variant. So, for example, there does seem to be an outbreak of B.1.1.7 in Michigan, for example. But if you look at the trends of what's happened with COVID in the United States over the course of the pandemic, that's been true all along. So early on, back in March and April, we had a huge surge in the Northeast, particularly in Massachusetts, New York, and New Jersey. Things kind of settled down there, and then Florida took off over the summer. So in July, Florida was kind of peaking at much higher than everybody else. And then California was actually leading the numbers in late December, early January. So one of the challenges of getting this pandemic under control has been the fact that it's been kind of moving around the country, and different parts of the country are having outbreaks at different times.
It's whack a SARS-CoV-2. All right, Dr. Brewer, thank you so much for joining us as always. We appreciate you so much. And our thanks to not just you, but all your colleagues, UCLA School of Public Health. We deeply appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Timothy Brewer joining us as he does just about weekly on Air Talk. One of our tremendous medical experts. He's epidemiologist as well as physician and professor of medicine, UCLA School of Public Health. Coming up, we'll talk about a rather remarkable laboratory breakthrough in using a robotic womb for partial gestation of a mouse embryo. We'll talk about what the implications are for better understanding embryonic development, what that might mean for humans as well. We'll talk about that coming up in 90 seconds here on Air Talk.
Support comes from Ciclovia, catalyzing vibrant public spaces, active transportation, and good health through car-free streets. Ciclavia promotes respect and infrastructure for bike and pedestrian-friendly public spaces. Enjoy these pop-up parks for the day in your favorite people-powered way. Jogging, biking, skating, strolling, or simply spectating. Free and open to all, Ciclavia Sundays generate miles of smiles in neighborhoods all over L.A. Details at www.ciclavia.org.